Hi, I'm Jada Cesar, mental health and body positive advocate.
And I'm Louise Troen, the Vice President of International Marketing and Communications at Bumble.
And welcome to Unsubscribe, the podcast that aims to help you unsubscribe from the negative habits in your life and resubscribe to healthier, happier modes of living. We're joined by a host of amazing guests for our first series who are pioneering the way in their respective industries and breaking boundaries along the way.
This podcast is brought to you by Bumble, and we are the social networking app that's focused on encouraging women to make the first move in love, in friendship, and in business. The first movers on this podcast are real testament to what can be achieved when you go after exactly what you want. Scarlett Curtis is the curator of the Sunday Times bestseller Feminists Don't Wear Pink and Other Lies. She has written for The Guardian, The Telegraph, amongst many others, and is currently the contributing editor at Sunday Times Style. She co-founded the Pink Protest and is a committed activist, mental health advocate, and all-round remarkable individual. This woman is running so fast to do good that we're thrilled that she's taking a pit stop with us today. Let's get started.
I think hot yoga is for people that don't like yoga.
Yeah, it is. I hate yoga.
That's exactly why I did it.
I love yoga, so I hate hot yoga.
I hate having to hot yoga makes me work out harder. But also, quicker.
Everyone comes in this. Mine, everyone comes in their swimsuits.
Yeah, I do.
The guys come in their board shorts, and the women are in their bikinis. I'm like, it's very strange.
Bikini. I definitely wear shorts and as little as possible.
Yeah,
I'm perfect.
Maybe I need to try it more. I just love yoga so much.
Yeah. So yeah, I think we wanted to kick off with sort of the beginning and thinking about you before Pink Protest and before Feminists Don't Wear Pink and Other Lies, and really get an understanding of who you were as a child, what kind of house you grew up in, and then we want to talk a little bit about purpose following that. So tell us a bit about you, about Scarlett, when you were younger.
Yes, so me as a child, I think I was basically always quite anxious, and I think that has definitely explained me as I've grown up. But I'm the oldest child. I have three younger brothers. I grew up in a very amazing household, but it was very busy. I always say that our house is basically a train station, and you come downstairs every day and there's 10 different people that you have no idea who they are, and they're all doing different things and they have no idea who you are. And I think I just always found life quite overwhelming. When I started at my primary school, I screamed solidly for a week because I was so freaked out by going to school, and I was known as the naughtiest girl in school, and I would stand up in the middle of assemblies and tell them my dad very coolly got an OBE when I was younger, and I remember I stood up once when I was five in assembly and went, "My dad knows the Queen and he's going to get you all arrested for child abuse." And I was 6 years old, and all they were trying to do was make me go to school. But I just couldn't handle it. And then weirdly, after 2 weeks of screaming, I just was completely fine. And then I was a really kind of geeky, obsessive student. I was just always quite, I think it's quite an oldest child thing. Mm. Are either of you oldest children?
No.
I'm middle.
I think of you as an oldest child.
Really?
Yeah. My friend believes that your sibling placement is the most important defining factor about you. Yeah, she's obsessive about it. I just think I always felt quite a lot of responsibility and pressure, and it never came from my parents. It always came from me. But I went to a very, I worked really hard in school. I went to a very academic school. Very high pressured. I always pushed myself loads. I always wanted to do things, and I was really into school. I remember being so excited when we started doing GCSEs because I wanted to revise and practice my revision. And then I think so. When I was 14, I got really, really ill, really suddenly, and dropped out of school and dropped out of everything. And I think that made it even harder because everything in my life up until then had been so driven. I loved school. I loved my friends. I was, obsessed with not missing one party or one lesson or one thing. And then to suddenly be out of everything was such a shock to the system.
Well, also if you're an academic and you're doing well,
yeah,
you feel like you have control over that situation, and then something hits you which you have no control over. And that can be a really disabling
Completely, yeah. And I think also, like, I actually have this thing now where I get really sad and emotional when I see, like, teenagers, which freaks a lot of teenagers out. So I'm like, they're just so beautiful. Enjoy this time. like,
okay. And you literally look like a teenager yourself. I'm like, how old are you?
but
just stand outside of schools crying.
I lived in New York for four, sorry I'm jumping over place, but I lived in New York 4 years, and I missed my little brothers so much that whenever I would see young boys I would cry. I would just be on the tube. Like, I remember once being on the tube and there were these three young little boys and I just burst into tears and they looked at me like, oh my god, who is this woman with pink hair is sobbing at us. Yeah, I also think what's so amazing about being young and being a teenager is that you think these things in your life are so important, and that actually that kind of prepares you for later on, and it gives you this perspective, and to suddenly realise that they weren't important, and also I wasn't able to do them, and it was such a, I think that more than anything was the hardest thing to like get my head around.
A question going back to the family home, yes. Family dynamics, having that like busyness in the house. Did you feel that made you feel more confident being around new people in life? Do you feel like that set you up? Did you ever feel kind of a little bit on edge having new people in your home environment?
Yeah, I think I've always felt like I was maybe like, this sounds quite odd, but I think I always felt like my family had this really big life, and actually, and it's still something I think about a lot and deal with. I think I'm better suited to quite a small life. Like, the other day I went up to, my granny has always lived in Suffolk and we go there all the time, and I went up there on my own for 4 days, and I called my mum on Thursday and she was like, are you still in Suffolk? I was like, yeah. And she was like, have you spoken to a person in 4 days? And I was like, no. And I hadn't even realised that I hadn't had a human interaction in 4 days. And I just love things to be quite small. I like routines and, you know, to feel like I'm safe. And my family is amazing, but it never felt like that. It was always big and exciting and new things happening and new things going on. And obviously that was such an incredible privilege to grow up in that. I just think it never like fully suited who I am as a person.
I mean, I can imagine that. That's kind of what I kind of like, my guttural instinct was as a kid, maybe seeing all these people in and out in your like little safe space can be quite overwhelming.
Yeah.
In like that developmental period.
Yeah, it definitely was. And I think it was probably good for me, because I think if it had been the other way and then I'd left school and then all of this and I'd had like I've been an only child in a really quiet house, I would have just become a total like recluse and never spoken to anyone. It kind of forced me to like keep going with social interaction.
But also to have your own self-sense of voice. You know, if I think of you as an individual now, so much of what you're doing is changing and giving wider communities a voice through your channels and your platforms and the different things you do. And I wonder if this is fair to say that constant community in your house, where perhaps you didn't have that consistent space to have that large voice, pushed you to find it elsewhere in some respects.
I think it definitely did. And I also think it kind of, you know, I think the real core of the reason I do everything I do now and that I'm so obsessed with feminism and all these kind of issues is I felt very othered when I was really young. You know, obviously this isn't true, but to my 14-year-old brain, my family was perfect and we'd had this perfect life and all our friends were perfect and everyone was happy and everyone was successful. And then suddenly I couldn't walk, I was out of school, I was miserable, I couldn't do any of the other things, and I felt like such a freak for so long, like in a real like kind of deep sense of that word. Like I felt so, yeah, othered is a really good way to put it, because it was just, I wasn't like everyone else. And that really led me, I think some people that makes them angry or kind of, but it, what it did for me was it just made me hate myself. I just thought I was wrong and I had done something wrong or I had, you know, messed up in some way that had made me not be able to follow this life plan that everyone else seemed to be able to follow. And I think going through those that experience so young, when I then started to read these books about feminism or these books about inequality or oppression, I was like, oh, this isn't just me. Like, and it's not my fault. It's a bigger thing, and it's a bigger, other people are feeling this way. And also other people are feeling this way in much, much more intense ways. And that was an amazing, you know, I always say, like, for me, feminism is self-help. Like, it was an amazing thing for me to realize that. And it helped me more than any therapy or any kind of anything ever else that ever did.
Could you go back and tell our listeners what it was that happened?
Yeah. So when I was 14, I had an operation on my spine. And what we now know is something went wrong in the operation. And it left me in complete chronic pain for 3 years. I couldn't really walk. I was always in pain. I couldn't wear something I kind of forgot until recently. I couldn't wear anything that even touched my back because my back was so sensitive and painful. I found that out because I was going through my bedroom and I was like, why are all my clothes size like 30? I was like, oh yeah, that was when I was 14. But yeah, so I was just, and I had to drop out of school. I lost all my friends. I developed really bad PTSD, anxiety, depression. And then during that time, I was very misdiagnosed and very badly treated by a lot of doctors and people. And then finally, after 3 years, we found out what was going on. And now, thankfully, I have no pain anymore, which is amazing. But yeah, it took a real toll on my brain, some might say.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about purpose and how much that means to you.
I think it means everything to me, but it's not like a cognitive thing. It's like almost like a subconscious thing. Like, I am insanely driven and ambitious and have this sense of something, but I have no idea why I need to do all the things I do or kind of feel it. It's actually something I really try and work out. My mum's always like, just stop. Like, why do you feel the need to do all this stuff? And I don't even really know. I sometimes think it's like making up for lost time. Like, I feel this real need to, I did nothing. I felt like I did nothing for so long. And I also think my dad has it as well. And I don't think he really knows why he has it. And I think my mum has it too. Like,
when you say has it, what do you mean?
Just this. So my parents run Comet Relief and a lot of other kind of, over the years, a lot of other campaigns and activism things. And, you know, whenever my dad was also a film writer and director, along with my mum, they worked together. But whenever anyone asked me what my dad did for a living, I just thought he worked for a charity. Like, it's so much of their lives. It's everything. And they've never earned a penny from it. And they never, you know, none of their parents did it. We're in this world. Like, they just have this kind of, and they're still doing it. 30 years later, they just have this drive of purpose, I guess. It's a really good word to use because it's just like this need to do these things. And I think none of us really know where it comes from. It's genuinely like this weird religion. I think all of us sometimes wish we didn't have it because it's quite, I sometimes just wish I could be really self. I mean, it's not, there's definitely selfish things about all of it, but it's an odd feeling.
I feel like when you can see the change that that purpose is having, it fuels more passion to do more of it. And I think with charity work or work you do or work we do at Bumble, it's like when you can see the difference in one person, then you want to make a difference in 10 people. And then you want to make a difference in 100 people.
I think that's completely it. So I've worked at loads of charities and different activist groups over the years. And I know so many people that work there and then would try and go back to like PR or marketing or like, you know, working for some company who just has no social impact and you can't go back. And I always say, like, charity is addictive. And I really think that's it. Once you start on any kind of thing, like, it can even be the smallest thing. It can be if, you know, you're a dog walker, but that makes the people you walk the dogs for really happy. You get addicted to that feeling. And you're like, I have to keep doing this. I can't just go back to doing something that doesn't give you that buzz. Like, for me, it really is like drugs. Like, it's...
But you're right, though, because then, and I think we feel this a lot, then you get exposed to the wealth of other problems and issues. Exactly. And then you start looking at whether it's feminism or whether it's inequality, whether it's race, whether it's climate change, you know, all of these buckets then become open for you to make a difference in. And then the pressure and the kind of expectation you put on yourself can be quite challenging when you are just one.
Yeah.
Which is why businesses and infrastructure like you've built and various others are so important, because they enable more of a movement to happen as opposed to one person trying to fight the fight independently.
Totally. But I also think there's amazing things about it. Like, I am really obsessed with inequality in quite an odd way. I think it really has been the key for me with my mental health to understanding the world around me. I did my degree in kind of the study of social movements and how social movements work. And within that, there was a lot of courses on kind of development and social inequality and social structures. And there's nothing I find more fascinating or interesting than studying like oppression, basically. And I just think it is so key to like understanding the world around you and also not blaming yourself for these things that we feel. And for me, once I'd started looking into all that, the feeling of, you know, I truly, something I believe at the core of everything I do is that one person can make a huge difference. And even if that's just doing something small, if we all did those things every day, it would spread. And I think for a long time, I felt like I wasn't doing enough. And that was a feeling I couldn't live with. That was a feeling that just felt horrible. And kind of, you'd read, that was when I was in this stage of like reading the news every day and just finding it impossible to deal with. And once I started to join these activist groups or these communities, that was the thing for me that really made me feel at peace in some ways, because I was with people that were this community of amazing women often who were doing things. And so I think, I don't know, and I think it's hard in the world we're living in now, especially where we are so exposed to so much information, it's hard to not feel like you should do something.
I think also it's really interesting that the causes we attach ourselves to, they do often say something about the individual.
Oh, completely.
Because it's triggering or it's reigniting something and fueling something within ourselves that matter quite personally.
Yeah.
So I find it...
Yeah. I love, and me and my friend talk about this all the time, but like looking at people and the cause they've chosen and why they've chosen that cause, because I know you know, with me, I care so deeply about feminism and mental health and any kind of discrimination, you know, whether that's race or disability or gender, and all the other, you know, climate change I intellectually care about a lot, poverty I intellectually care about a lot, there are so many things I intellectually care about, but anything having to do with women just gets me like in my gut in such a different way. And you see that with everyone. You know, I have friends who feel that gut way about climate change. My parents feel that gut way about poverty. And I love it. I love like the psychology behind why we care about the things we do.
Well, I think you've touched on a really great point of how important communities are and purpose. Like purpose can like make you want to live a life that maybe could have been difficult before, but it's because you've kind of, you know, unanimously come together and united with people that feel this joint oppression.
Yeah.
And that's what you've united by, you're united by.
Yeah. Or feel this sense of purpose for some reason that they can do something, which is also a weird thing to feel.
But it's also incredibly like fulfilling. And I think we're all, of course, we're all searching for happiness, but we're all looking for a fulfilled life at the end of it, right? That's the number one thing. I want to have fulfilled my potential and I want to do good and I want to be happy. Those are sort of the ultimate things for me anyway. And I think it's impossible to feel fulfilled unless you are exercising a passion and a cause that you care about. And often people forget that that most, more often than not, is a cause that needs support, whether it's feminism, whether it's climate, whatever, whichever one bucket it sits in. It's not necessarily, you know, getting married at the right age or following the expectations of like the success point in life. It's actually feeling fulfilled that you have fulfilled your potential by making a difference
completely
for future generations.
And I think really interesting what you just said, because I actually think, and this is something I'm like trying to deal with now a bit more, but I was so miserable for so long, and I genuinely think I stopped believing that I could be happy. Like I remember once when I think when I was like 19, I was in New York and I was just like, I'm just never going to be happy. Like I'm never going to, that has to be what I stop aiming for, because it's not going to be for me. And because of that, I think I threw everything I had into fulfillment and into purpose, basically, because I was like, well, you know, happiness is out the window. That's fine. I'll just like, I remember being like, it's fine. I'll just live alone with my cat forever and it's going to be great. And, but because of that, I think a lot of people put all their eggs in the happiness basket and just strive for that. And there's great merit in that, but I think often it doesn't lead to what you're aiming for. And I think what happened with me was I didn't even aim for happy, because I thought, because of my mental health, I thought it was just never going to be for me. And I really just was like, what I can do is I can work, and I can work for other people, and I can try and make some kind of difference in the world. And those are things I can do, and I'll get all of my fulfillment from that. And that's kind of what I've been doing for the last few years, and it's definitely worked. But I also think I am basically trying to figure out where my just pure happiness comes from.
But you know, happiness is a trick. They sell happiness to us, and it's completely, it's packaged up incorrectly.
Yeah.
Happiness isn't that new car. It's not the next job. No. It's not getting married. It's not the new upgraded boyfriend. It's not that body you're trying to get next year.
It's not a holiday and
it's not. And the thing is, all of these are quick fixes that are going to temporarily distract you. And real happiness is purpose.
Yeah. And I think, weirdly, I realized that really young, but almost too much. Like now I'm at a stage where I'm like, you know, you could do all the stuff you do and like not work 24 hours a day. And like, you know, I'm looking now for more balance. And it's an interesting journey, because it so wasn't. I just thought I was never going to have that. I thought I was never going to have friends. I was never going to have a boyfriend. I was just going to be this kind of weird little lady that worked and didn't do anything else.
How I'm interested how your confidence in yourself has evolved from that period where you got sick to finding the purpose to now, in terms of how that's affected your other relationships. So if you felt, you know, you weren't worthy of being in a relationship, or you didn't have that many friends, now, you know, I don't know anyone who has more friends than you, and I'm sure every man listening to this would want to date you, but I'm interested like how that journey has evolved and where you are now in terms of that confidence, and whether it's still a work in progress or
what? It's definitely still a work in progress. I think I'm a lot more, it's not as much confidence as, for me, the biggest thing was accepting myself. Like, I think I had this, and this is why I think like the unsubscribe idea is so good, because I think I had this thing in my head, and it was because I was so sick for so long. And when you're sick, all you talk about is being better. Like, I, in my head, there was this girl who was better, and better just came to mean everything in the world that I was lacking. So when I was better, I would be physically healthy, I would be mentally healthy, I would be confident, I would be social, I would be all of these things. And a huge moment for me was realizing I was never going to get better in that way. I was never going to be this person that I thought was better. And actually, probably no one in the world is that thing. Like, I thought everyone else was fully healthy and happy, and I was broken. And I, because of that, I delayed my life until I was better. So I'd be like, well, you know, I can't do that now, but I'll do it when I'm better. I can't get that job now because I'll do it when I'm better. I can't, all this stuff. And at some point, I was just like, this is never going to happen. Like this, you're never going to get there. And you just have to start doing the things you want to do that you can do and dealing with whatever comes with that. So I started doing all this stuff, predominantly work things, because that was the thing I felt most comfortable with. And through work was actually how I found most of my friends and most of my people. And that was huge for me because I definitely used to have this label on myself where I was like, I have no friends. And that was like a real, you know, when we talk about like the things we tell ourselves and the beliefs we have, it wasn't true. I had so many people that loved me, but in my head, I had no friends. And finding my community through work and starting to be able to let people in has really helped me just become more confident, I think, and accept myself. And I think naturally I'm never going to be a super confident person. I think sometimes we confuse confidence and acceptance because I'm never going to be like loud and out there and, you know, but I do accept myself in a way that is much better than
me. I think that's amazing. I do think though that confidence doesn't necessarily need to mean loud and you walk into a room. It can also mean finding your purpose and taking charge of that in a way that doesn't need to be overzealous. You know, the things that you've done, Scar, with all of the projects you're working on are really confident projects.
Yeah.
And you do it all with confidence.
And I do think in a lot of areas of my life, I do have a kind of deep confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I don't really know where that comes from because in some other areas of my life, I'm so underconfident.
Mm.
I don't know if either of you have that, but it's like funny when all the scales are a bit off.
I think everybody has that. But also for me, do you not find like Sundays I'll wake up and I'll be like, oh, it's a good day. Like I've got my mojo, like things are going to go well. And then other days I'll wake up and I'll be like, oh, today is going to be a tough day and you need to just manage
But then
that.
Also in that day, you then show up for yourself and you're like, whoa, how did that happen?
Sometimes you get more done in the bad days because you're like trying harder. It's also funny what we find easy. So like me and my friend were actually talking about this the other day because we were talking and she's going through a bit of a tough time. She's like, I find it hard to talk to you sometimes because you're so confident in your work and I'm not. She was saying this to me. And it was so, and she was like, and I just look at you doing all this work and it makes me feel really insecure. And I was like, that is so mad because I look at her and she is so social and, you know, she flirts with loads of boys and she goes out every night and she drinks loads. And like, my New Year's resolution was to drink more and I've gotten drunk like twice. and I find flirting impossible, like categorically impossible.
I mean, we don't know how to do it.
I that should be this podcast, just us figuring out how to flirt. If someone can tell me, please. And I look at the things she does and I'm like, so it makes me feel insecure. And you have to be quite open about the things you find easy and things you find hard, because otherwise people are going to be looking at you and being like, how can she do that? But it just, different things come naturally, I really believe, to different people. And we should all be more honest. Like, I'm really confident in my work and really underconfident in my social or like sexual abilities.
But it would be almost, you know, you'd be superhuman or completely alien if you were able to do everything,
you know,
all at the same time. Like it's impossible. Something that I like to talk about, and I know me and Lou always like mull over the idea of like what mental health is, what does it look like, how did your mental health difficulties show up, how did you recognize them?
So for me, I'm really obsessed with mental health because I think whenever we say that word mental health, you think about mental illness because we never actually talk about mental health. And we should all, I mean, this has been said a lot of times, but we should all be talking about our mental health like our physical health, because it is just as important. And I now do so much to try and look after my mental health in a positive way. But I did suffer from mental illness really badly for a long time and in quite an extreme way. And I think there are so many we also have to be specific about what we're talking about when we talk about mental illness, because something I see a lot when I talk about mental illness and the things I get back are people who are just struggling with the daily anxieties of life. And that is, you know, I think we all know that's like soaring, and especially in young girls, like anxiety is insanely on the rise. But yeah, so I definitely deal with that. And I think that's closer to what I deal with now. I get very, very anxious. I get panic attacks quite a lot. I get very low still. I have in the past been diagnosed with PTSD, depression and anxiety. I had periods of my life, about 2 years, where I literally couldn't leave the house without having a panic attack. And I was, could barely get out of bed. And that has now kind of, again, with the better thing, I think when I was going through that, I was like, one day I'll be completely mentally healthy and I'll never have a panic attack again, and I'll never feel sad and I'll never feel low. And a huge thing for me now has been being like, okay, so I do still get anxious, I still get low, I still deal with a lot of the trauma that I used to deal with, but it's all just at a much lower scale.
How old were you when you recognised that you were going through panic attacks and disorders?
So I got physically better when I was 17, almost 18, and I had thought that when I was physically better, I would be the happiest person in the whole world. It's like, if I just didn't have this pain anymore, I will run marathons and I'll, you know, be going out every night and I'll be so happy. And at that point, I tried to go back to school, having been out of school for like 3 years. And I was like, every day that I was there for 6 months, and every day I just got more and more and more and more unhappy. And it was honestly all the cheesy metaphors you hear about mental illness are the case. It was like this dark, dark cloud that just ascended over me. And I now know that it was PTSD. And but at the time I really blamed myself, because I was like, you have everything you've ever wanted. You don't have pain anymore. You know, I'd been in hospitals for 3 years with people who were never going to not be in pain, who were never going to be fully physically recovered. And I had that. It had happened. It was like a miracle. And I couldn't understand why, after all of that, I was still miserable. And then I just had a full-on breakdown. And
I mean, I think there's a lot of you've hit some really great points. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding around, I think, depression in particular, to the fact that, like, it's not the result of a sum necessary of instances. It can sometimes come on incredibly randomly.
It's completely chemical.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there are lots of people have triggers that can set off those dark clouds. But the challenging thing with it is when you go to the doctor, and, you know, I've been through various different experiences of it myself. You know, nobody scans your brain like they would if you go in and you say, I've hurt my leg, I think it's broken. You know, you don't walk in and go, I think my brain's broken because I've been crying all day and I have everything I've ever wanted and I still feel sad. And I think, you know, the moment that we have neurology to a point where we can actually scan and see the chemical imbalances, it won't be unpicked in a way that it needs to be. And I fully understand that, like, you know, there's nothing more challenging than not being able to identify a problem and fix it.
It's the hardest thing. And I still, it's so funny. I talk about mental health all the time. I talk about smashing the stigma. I talk about all of this. To this day, when I have, because I still get days where I can't get out of bed. They're much less now, but they still happen. And I blame myself. And I call my mum and I'm like, I hate myself for it. And she's amazing with it, and the thing she always says to me is, it's like a broken leg. If you call me and were like, I've broken my leg, I can't get out of bed, you wouldn't blame yourself, you wouldn't hate yourself, you wouldn't be angry at yourself. But with all the things I know, and this is why I am such a big advocate for it, because I have had the best treatment, I live in the most liberal family, I know people that have been through mental illness, if I'm still blaming myself for every day of depression, can you imagine what it's like if you don't have those things? Like,
yeah, you said something really interesting on another podcast. You said, people say, be kind to yourself, stay at home, don't stay at home, be in your own company, be in company. You felt that your brain was your own imposter and you couldn't trust it. Tell me a bit more about that.
It's completely. I think it's, this is something I think people don't talk about enough. And it's, for me, it's been the biggest thing was like, I still feel like I can't trust my brain. Like, my brain tells me things that are completely wrong. It tells me, you know, that I'm an awful person. It tells me that I'm to blame for all these horrible things. I've been very paranoid in the past, like kind of in a really scary way. I used to think everyone in the world was conspiring against me and all these different things. And so, but it's also what I rely on for everything. It's like your brain is kind of who you are. And when that turns against you, I think for me what it led to was a lot of just anxiety about what I can trust, like which of my feelings I can trust. You know, sometimes I'll feel tired, and I am genuinely tired because I've been working too hard, but I'll say to myself, like, no, that's probably your depression talking. Or, you know, I'll feel worried about something and I won't know if it's real or not real. And I found that really hard to live with, is that experience of losing control of my brain and losing control of my emotions. And then I think trying to get back to some kind of trust in yourself after that is really hard.
Mm. I mean, yeah, I fully agree with that. And I also think that you can overcomplex it yourself by opening yourself up to all of these different influences that come into your life.
Yeah.
So whether it's social media or TV or your... I remember when I went through depression, I was reading so much about it because I was like, if I learn everything, then I can fix it.
Over-intellectualism is such a thing.
And I remember going to the doctor and him saying, well, we think we should give you this medication. And I was like, well, actually, I've read in page 84 of this you know, massive medicine textbook that this is the best one for me based on these reasons. And they ended up being like, okay, and I ended up not taking it. But I tried to over-intellectualize myself on it so that I could fix it for myself, because I didn't trust that, you know, the medicine and the doctor industry knew me as an individual. And I think it's a really dangerous path to go down. And we were talking about this earlier, you know, over-Googleizing and asking too many questions and actually trying to remember that majority of the time it's temporary. And when I say temporary, you know, it can last years, but it always lifts at some point. And trusting that it's a process that you need to face front on, as opposed to a problem that you just need to fix.
Totally. I think that's so true. And I think you see that a lot now, you know, with all these things that people feel. I think one tough part, we're all talking about mental health more, and it's great, but I also think sometimes it can add to the pressures that we put on ourselves. So, you know, you see it with people who are like, I'm feeling bad, but I should be meditating and I should be doing yoga and I should be doing this and I should be doing this. And it's like, those things are great and we should all be embracing them, but we can't let them become just another standard we're failing at.
What works for some people isn't going to work for you.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, we should be doing all of these things in order to live this prescribed happy life. Like, actually, it's figuring out what works for you. And what I was going to say around like feeling like you've lost your mind or are losing your mind, without sounding too woo-woo, it's like becoming grounded again.
Yeah.
Just getting right back down to
grounded
basics.
Grounded is the word that, you know, when like a word keeps coming up to you in the last few weeks, I've actually had a really wobbly few weeks, and all I've been hearing is the word grounded. And I'm like, that is the word I need.
Because that's how you're going to feel like, I have a reference point for what normal feels like.
Yeah.
This is how I can trust myself. And it's like what they say. I know when I went for a massive grieving period, we all slept on the floor.
Wow.
On like, I pulled out like loads of duvet covers and I slept on the floor with my mum, my brother.
Yeah.
And it's like being back on the ground, back to basics,
so
back
beautiful.
In connection with the earth. And I'm like not a yogi or anything like that, but it does have such a difference on like feeling that you're in control again.
Totally.
And knowing what feels like reality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think completely. And I think just, and also, but then it's like, whatever does that for you. So like, I actually, yoga has been a huge part of what kind of has helped me. And I hate saying that, because for so long, everyone said to me, do yoga. And I was like, no, yoga will never work for me. I hate yoga. And it has really helped. But then there's also things like, for me, genuinely, when I'm feeling anxious, the only thing that helps is listening to an audiobook and playing Candy Crush. And I've tried everything. I've tried meditating. I've tried, you know, anything in the world. And it's just playing a game on my phone is the only thing. And like, I think we should talk more about those kind of things, not just these like goop standard perfect ways of looking after your mental health. For some people, it is, you know, another thing.
What's your top self-care tip?
Interesting. I was just thinking, I think something that's huge for me and my family, which I'm only just starting to realize is self-care, is pets. Like, I think my pets for me, my family has a million pets, and I have a cat. And
I just came to your house last week, and there were 55 cats in a basket.
Real, but it's genuinely is our self-care, because I think there's a really fine line with self-care, isn't there? Because there's the stuff you do that's like emergency, I need to look after myself, and that for me that's like bed, Netflix, Candy Crush, like just kind of go into that SOS zone.
Yeah, your toolkit. I always call it the mental health toolkit.
But then my long-term things would be yoga really, really helps me, my pets, and having like a routine even with like my dog or my cat where I just have to feed them, be responsible for them, look after them. I got a dog when I was 16, and I don't think I'd be alive without that dog. Like, just knowing I had to wake up to walk her and feed her was like the thing that kept me grounded. Exactly. And then something I'm trying to do more is like talk to people and reach out more, but I'm bad at that.
I think routine is a really good point in terms of being in, living kind of in harmony with being grounded, because having too many sporadic and erratic, chaotic lifestyle experiences gives you no sense of consistency, and also puts too many triggers in your brain all day, every day. Like, your adrenaline is just, you know, I find this sometimes with the amount that I travel, that it's just consistent and constant adrenaline, and actually you need to stabilize
really
that.
Interesting about the thing where you were like, no one can scan your brain. I did a blood test the other day for something completely different, and the doctor was like, your adrenals are off the scale. Like, you have so much adrenaline like pumping on your body, and that's like because of anxiety. And it was, even though I talk about mental illness being real all the time, it was such a huge moment to be like, wow, you can actually see that on a chart.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Like, that's it's real. It's very real.
I think also I just wanted to touch on another point you made about Candy Crush for anyone that's listening that is suffering from depression, or, you know, is challenged in those moments, that it's a really great point that I've heard recurringly over the last 6 months, that, you know, therapy and medication, of course, professional advice is absolutely something you should seek and explore, but there is such value in distracting your brain in a moment.
Yeah.
And when you think of distraction as a concept, you think of it as a negative thing. You think about being unfocused. And when you're sad or low, you think you have to focus on fixing it. But I just wanted to mention that I was exactly the same, that reading fictional books that were about Molly going shopping on a Saturday, and
I can
only
read fiction.
It's so powerful because it tricks your brain into rediverting to a place where it can't focus on the lowness and that chemical piece. So you can actually restructure it through distraction. And I think it's a really valuable point that I want to reiterate to anyone listening, that whatever it might be for you, like for me, it was fiction and it was being in nature, because I felt that things were bigger than me, and like the wind was stronger and the trees were larger, and I felt the perspective distracted me. But if you can find what those pieces are that distract you instead of indulging in it, can be really powerful.
Oh, act on it, because like you said, it will pass. And what I have learned, I am good at dealing with the real lows now. And what I have learned is when I get that real, real low, if I have a conversation with someone, it will go wrong. Like, something will go wrong because my brain is off. If I try and think about what's going to help, I'll end up in the weirdest, worst place. All I can do is distract myself. And I am honestly the queen of distraction. I used to do huge Lego kits, was my biggest thing when I have like really bad periods, because I mean, I've built Tower Bridge. I don't know if anyone's a Lego fan.
You should hang out with my older brother. He literally spent our entire childhood building around our kitchen.
Yeah, so I built everything, and there was a stage where my parents were like, we're going to have to start throwing these away because our entire house is filled with these insane Lego kits. But you just have to get through it, and it will get better, and then you'll be in a place where you can think clearly, and then you can think about what's going to help. But in that moment, do not try and meditate. Do not try and, like, you know, fix it. Do not try and do all that. Just get through it.
I think on a really basic level as well, sometimes even putting language to it can help. So I never knew that mulling over an idea and having that dark cloud was you ruminating and was you having a thought on a loop.
Yeah, circular thoughts.
And when I heard, oh, am I, this idea is now on loop, because at the moment it feels really like, even though it's quite indulgent, it feels like I need to be thinking about it, and I should be, and I can't think of anything else because almost it shouldn't deserve that attention. But actually, you're just currently on a loop, and you need to now take off the record and walk out of the house.
Completely.
And that for me was able to allow me to retain some control of the situation. Yeah.
And also the loop, like with anything, like if I'm in a really bad place and I like go out to a restaurant, I'll like be looking at the menu and then like burst into tears because I can't decide. And it seems like the most important decision in the whole world. Like everything in my brain just kind of goes haywire. And so the only thing I can do in that moment is distraction.
But there's such strength, Scar, in like being able to sit here despite, you know, going through all of that and speak so articulately about it. And it's, you know, you're a real example of someone who is taking the most vulnerable parts of them, which, you know, at times have been incredibly vulnerable, and packaging them up in a way to help others understand.
Honestly, it helps me more than anyone else, I think. That has been the only way. I live with so much shame for so long about everything to do with me. And genuinely, like, my whole career has basically just been like a form of therapy for myself. Like, it's the only way I can get through it is by talking about it completely, honestly. And I honestly think for everyone, once you start talking about it, the shame is gone.
Yeah, shame can't live in the light.
No, not at all. Like, as soon as you say it, it's over.
Mm. So tell us, what gives you the strength to keep on inspiring?
Keep on inspiring. I don't know if I do inspire.
We're telling you.
You're telling me. I don't know. I genuinely think I just love it. Like, I really love what I do, and I love working, and it makes me properly happy. Like, there's nothing, I never ever feel more excited or connected to the world than when I'm doing Pink Protest stuff. Like, it is just the it makes me feel this kind of happiness that I never thought I'd feel. And I genuinely think the day that it doesn't, I'll probably stop, because I think, you know, with all this activism stuff, if it doesn't bring you some kind of joy or some kind of sense of fulfillment or purpose, you don't have to do it. There are more important things in the world, and someone else will do it. But for now, my work makes me so happy, and it makes me feel connected, and it makes me feel like I'm part of something. And all the good things that come from it, for me, that's the most important thing, I think.
So Jada often asks this, and I think it's a really brilliant question. What do you think is most misunderstood about you? So from people from the outside, I can't take any credit for this. This is Jada's question. But I love it because it's a chance for you to kind of explain what do you think people think about you that isn't right, or that people expect you to be that isn't the case?
I think there's two things. The other day, my family voted me least funny member of the family, and that seriously upset me. So
what game was this?
Honestly, I don't know. They voted me most stylish.
Okay.
But least funny. So I actually think I'm quite funny, and I would like to tell my family that, that they misunderstand that about me.
Maybe just they have terrible sense of humour.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, honestly, my mum is not.
I didn't think
funny.
Your dad was that funny when I met him.
Exactly. And then in general, I know the thing that's most misunderstood about me is people think I'm much more of a hardline feminist than I am. And I am a hardline feminist, but people get confused about what feminism is, I think, and they think I'm gonna be angry about things I'm not. So like, my life now is basically people going like, oh, don't say that in front of Scarlett, or like, oh, Scarlett won't like that. And often it's things that actually aren't unfeminine. Like, people have just completely misunderstood it. And everything, my whole feminism as well, is about talking to people and being, working through things. And, like, you know, I have three younger brothers, all of whom listen to, like, insanely sexist rap music. And I've had to, like, talk them through that and kind of... So I think that is often, just at the moment, that's, like, a big misunderstanding that a lot of people have about me.
But that's brilliant.
Yeah.
That is brilliant.
Interesting. And I think a lot of other feminists go through that, and you're not alone if you do, because it's quite an annoying place to be in.
But then it's re-educating like them that being a feminist doesn't mean that you have to be shouting about something or be angry necessarily.
Or, like, all of this. You do feel like a school teacher sometimes, I think.
Which is why you wrote a book, or you're the author of a book, which is about reframing what feminism is and educating people on actually. So if anyone's listening, it's called Feminists Don't Wear Pink and Other Lies. You should definitely read
it. It's very fun. And I have huge pink trainers on today, so I'm definitely...
And this feminist actually does wear pink.
Lots of pink.
Yeah. Cool.
Oh, this has been so amazing. I just want to say, on the podcast, I think both of you are so incredible. And, like, for a huge part of, like, I think I would never... What I feel is so amazing about what's happening now is I feel surrounded by this community of incredible women, some of whom I know, some of whom I don't know. But that is actually the thing that gives me all the confidence in the world to, like, do anything. And that's the thing I never thought I'd have. And it's just amazing. So thanks for having me on, guys.
Thank you so much for coming on.
And just before we do our food bit... So obviously we're called Unsubscribe because we're about unsubscribing from traditional expectations and conditioning and resubscribing to patterns of behaviour and attitudes that can lead us to lead better lives. In terms of what you are unsubscribing from at the moment, if there was one thing that you wanted to share or one thing that you're hoping for in the future, what is that unsubscription or what is that resubscription?
Interesting. That you're working on. I was thinking about this on the way here. I actually have a lot of emails I need to unsubscribe from in general, because I don't know how to do that, and I get about 200 emails a day that aren't from people. They're just from
always at the bottom companies. Of that newsletter and the tiniest button.
Honestly, I don't think it works. One of the things I think is huge for me is unsubscribing from the belief that I need to say yes to everything. And I think that's huge for a lot of people.
Yeah,
and I think a lot of women, we feel like we should be grateful for anything we've been offered. Mm-hmm. We feel like we want to please everyone. We feel like we should just take every opportunity while we still can before we, like, have babies or something. I don't know what it is, but I feel that massively. And I think, especially because I just never thought I'd have any kind of a career, I feel so grateful for anything anyone offers me. But it's been a big thing for me to learn how to say no to things. And then resubscribe. I don't know.
Or just subscribe. Hard one. Subscribing to. Maybe being kinder to yourself.
I think that's always the thing for me. Being kinder to myself and having more fun. I think realizing
and that drinking more, I love
genuinely
that.
Like that. If that's still my New Year's resolution, I just need to.
I reckon you're the only person on the planet that.
Yeah,
that was your.
It's only happened twice since New Year,
but that's okay too.
Yeah, so I know.
Not you can have
well,
fun.
Again, it becomes a thing I use to be mean to myself. I'm like, you don't drink enough, so
but you know,
maybe I should just be nice to myself and be like,
have fun with that.
That's great.
Yeah,
got Haribo
and Candy Crush.
And candy.
Talking of Candy Crush or candy.
Oh, yeah.
Da-da-da. Segue.
Oh, my gosh.
Speaking of candy.
This is so...
We bring in our guests food that we think either they might like, which they don't usually, or...
I don't think anyone's liked
this
one
is so
of them.
Presents
them.
Okay.
so, I have brought some candy.
Oh, my God.
Multicoloured candy, because feminists don't wear pink. They can wear orange and green and yellow and blue and come in all shapes and sizes.
And they can be sweet. I love that.
And I also bought not want to eat, but it's basically vegan jerky. Okay, let me explain.
I love jerky, so I think I'll like this.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I get lucky.
It's funny because I lived in America, and in America, jerky is huge.
Yeah.
And I would have it all the time. And then you come back here and it's weird to have jerky.
Why I got vegan jerky in particular was because I think you're the kind of person that people
think I'm a jerk.
Might get an assumption. No, yes. I didn't even think about the jerk part. I was just thinking about how you can be disguised in one form and actually be something completely different. Like, you know, people might think you're like sweet and pretty and like wear pink, and but you are a force to be reckoned with. And I think that you can be a feminist and you can still have gone through like terrible trauma and diversity and still come out being strong and you know, not being something people expect.
God, this is
so
the most
there you
emotional
go.
Emotional jerky I've ever seen. I love that.
Jerky with an emotion.
Should we try this?
Go for it.
Open it.
Is that what you're meant to do?
Yeah, you're meant to eat it. Well, okay, we hope that the guests will actually eat the food. I mean, it's always a pro when they do.
Ever so quirky, vegan jerky. You have this before.
And you also have more.
Louise, mine are always like pun intended, because okay, otherwise it would get a bit heavy, you know? So I have you some nachos. Amazing. Because you are nacho average girl. You're welcome.
Also, have you done a whole series and not used that before?
I wake up in the middle of the night like, I got a new one.
I don't know anyone else quite like Lou. Like, I literally am
going to come.
It's
a shame I can't monetize puns. But, and then I got you some whole cashews because you're running so fast on the road to success that I can't cashew.
Oh my God. That one was awful. I'm sorry.
I'm so sorry.
I love cashews, but that was really bad. I like Nacho Average Girl.
But I actually
like Jada's way more. Sorry.
Everyone always
does. She gave me a whole emotional speech about how I'm vegan jerky.
Sorry, I didn't deliver that.
Vegan jerky.
Okay, I'm going to try the vegan jerky. What's in it?
I don't know. Yeah, but that's the surprise. Yeah.
That is the surprise.
But thank you so much for coming on,
yeah,
Scarlett.
We're so great.
It's been an actual pleasure.
And we can't wait. We can't wait to watch your journey. You know, you've so much.
Yeah, you're amazing.
Thank you.
Bye.
And that was Scarlett Curtis. If you like what you heard, we would love to know your thoughts. Rate, review, and share with a friend you think might like this also.
Unsubscribe is powered by Fourth Floor Creative and brought to you by Bumble, the social network where it's never too late to make the first move.